Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, little kitty cats. Sweet little pussy willows. Look, suddenly and without warning, I am doing the McCuntleth Comedy Festival in Wales this Friday. You know, Mac, or you don't, if you happen to be going, I'm gonna be there. I am stepping in last minute this Friday, May 3rd at 7 p.m. I know none of you are gonna be like, let me go to Western Wales for Sarah. But if you're going already, please know that I am there and Google MacFest and my name and buy a little ticket. Also, different part of the, I was going to say country, but it's a whole different country indeed. I will be back in England. I will be in Brighton for the Brighton Comedy Festival Wednesday, May 8th, Tuesday, May 14th, and Tuesday, May 21st. I'm doing a work in progress of my new show, Anything For You. It will be at the Edinburgh Fringe, but I need to work it up. So if you're in Western Wales or Southern England on any of the dates I've mentioned, get a fucking ticket.
So you're better?
Yeah. So I had tonsillitis. We know this. I still feel a thickness in the back of my throat, despite having finished my 7-day course of antibiotics. I found out midway through my course that I was supposed to be taking them 4 times a day on an empty stomach. This is genuinely just not an option for me, even when I'm ill, unless I have a stomach flu.
Because you never have an empty stomach.
My stomach is never empty. I don't. Also, it feels weird to me to take a pill when I haven't eaten something. I feel like I'm violating every rule I've ever learned. But also, it was like, I fucking loved being sick. Like, I'm nervous about not getting well, but what it resulted in was not leaving my house or getting off the sofa much for about 3.5 days.
That's why I enjoyed the pandemic. I mean, I didn't enjoy the great loss of human life and
then
the resultant damage to people psychologically.
No.
But I really enjoyed not doing anything.
I lost a loved one in COVID. My grandma died.
It's nothing to do with COVID.
No, but she was ready to die. My grandma, 99, finally. Boy, we'd been waiting since she was 80 for her to die. Someone turns 80 and you go, you're ready now. Now, if my dad drops dead tomorrow, he's 80, I would not be pleased. But I get that it's kind of his time. Oh. Do you know what? I'm seeing a good opportunity right now as we talk. I think I can bring our Patreon cell when we're there back to this topic.
Okay.
Yeah, I can really push for some funds from the listeners.
Now, should we tell them about who the guest is on this week's episode?
I know we're not supposed to choose favorites, but oh man, it felt very special to me. Did it feel special to you?
Yeah, I just liked him a lot.
Well, we liked him a lot and we thought we might not like him for reasons TBD, which we discussed openly with him. So I feel comfortable saying that.
Here's Will Tracy. Now, this man's CV, he was the editor of The Onion. I love The Onion so much. It's the most consistently funny thing.
Yes, it holds itself to a standard that kind of nothing else can.
So he was the editor of that.
Unbelievable.
He was then a writer on The John Oliver Show, which is some of the finest satire on television, after which he was a writer on this show, Succession, which aired on HBO, which you and I both enjoyed very much indeed.
Yeah, I did like it.
Yeah.
So I thought with a CV like that, I don't think he can be that nice. But I couldn't quite square this with the fact that everyone that we've had the privilege of encountering who's been in the Succession writer's room has been a real darling. And I thought, so I think Will Tracy was kind of the asshole, but he was so talented that Jesse Armstrong is like, look, I don't want to hang out with this guy, but for the quality of the show, I'll deal with that. That's what I thought we were in for.
You were wrong.
I was wrong.
So Will is the creator and showrunner of a new HBO show, which is airing on Sky and Now TV in the UK. It's called The Regime. It stars Kate Winslet. And We should say off the bat that it's had mixed reviews. Now, when I say mixed reviews, I mean mixed reviews. Yes. There was a glowing review in the New York Times.
Yes. A
highly esteemed publication. But some of the British reviews have been quite harsh. And we didn't get around to watching it until after the reviews were out. And having done that, I can't work out why some of the reviews have been as savage as they've been, apart from the fact that it's not Succession.
Yes.
Tonally, it takes a bit of switching into. There's some lovely writing. The performances are big. I think Kate Winslet is getting up some excellent comic stuff.
And if you're anything like me, or you have a mother anything like my mother, you will see both yourself and your mother reflected in Kate Winslet's character, because she's playing a psychotic dictator, which is in some ways what my mother is and who I am inside.
So our guest later is the creator and showrunner of The Regime, Will Tracy.
My quick watch this week, I watched season one of Le Bureau, The Bureau. The last person to recommend it to us was Mr. Hollywood himself, Eric Newman. I've watched all of season one in preparation for season two, which is thought of as basically the greatest bit of French TV ever made.
Wow.
I read something that said that. And you know what's really good? I haven't watched something with subtitles in a little while. And what's horrible but fantastic is you cannot look at your phone. So what the show is about generally is the dégueu... I can't say it in French, but the
go on, try.
Dégueu, A, B, C, D... Day, I know I can do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. Voici la petite chanson qui nous aide à dire les sons. I learned it in French.
No, did you make that up?
Shut up. Day, G, S. I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's the D, G, S, E, which I think is like...
Department.
It's the department of stuff, you know, that they do. And it focuses on these spies who go very deep undercover for years. And the way the story gets told, at least in this first season, is that we see our lead character, Guillaume, and he is just coming back from a 6-year deep spy situation.
Is it a mission, maybe?
Yeah. He's coming back from a 6-year mission in Damascus, as we also see another character preparing to leave for Iran.
Now, imagine you're watching this show and thinking there's no way you could be a spy.
There's no way I can be a spy, because you can't talk about anything that you've done at work.
Or your life.
Yeah, you can't talk about anything in your life.
You know, sometimes when people are in the advanced stages of dementia, and they just shout out something that happened to them when they were 20 and they're back in it. I would say about 60% of your conversation is just randomly bringing up things that happened to you between the years of 1985 and 1994.
I'm not destined for spydom, sadly, but I don't think I'd want to go. There's like a goodbye scene where the head of the agency is sending this young woman off to her mission in Iran. And he says something like, I've been busy. I haven't planned a speech. Maybe I see you in 2 years, maybe in 6, maybe in 10. Think of how I go if my schedule today changes. The idea of 2 years, 6 years, or 10, I don't think it's for me.
Is there a character you feel strongly about in this?
There is a job featured in this TV show that makes me realize I have never fully understood the idea of a dream job.
And it's within the department, the bureau.
Oui, they bring in a doctor, but it's psychologique, doctor de la mind. Because these agents get put under such intense psychological stress. And there are scenes in this show where this woman, her job is to sit across from someone and tell them that they're lying. To themselves.
So how do you apply for it?
I think the ship has sailed before you even try going down that route. It's not going to happen for me. But in my head, you know, you hear people say things like, oh, they always have this podcast on the go because they can't be alone with their own thoughts. I could walk 5 miles with no podcast because I'm playing out so many fantasy conversations in my head.
As the truth teller.
Is a million different things. Or people I want to be interested in me.
Who are they? The president?
I don't want to say, it's too private. But, you know, just different people who like are like, wow, Sarah, she is. That is someone with interesting observations.
Are they people you already know?
Yeah.
Are they very professionally accomplished within your profession?
Yeah. And they want to know what I think. And I could just play out those conversations on a big loop.
Okay, so Will Tracy, the guest on this week's episode.
Yeah.
What do you want him to ask you about?
It would be about a finished product. So it wouldn't be about a script he's working on. It would be about, like, the menu or the regime.
But in what world is somebody asking for too late now advice?
They're not. That's why it's my fantasy.
All right, to bring it back to the show, you like being in French spy world.
This show is fantastic and addictive and the best version of a thing.
I have a question.
Go on.
And I don't know if we're comparing apples and oranges here.
Mm.
Is it as good as Slow Horses? If we're in spy world.
I think probably Slow Horses is like big picture the better show because it's so funny. But what the Bureau has is, oh my God, I have to watch another. Like it does the cliffhanger better.
Maybe it's not apples and oranges, but it's pomme and pomme de terre.
Oh, yeah.
Before I talk about what I watched this week, name a pop superstar.
Beyonce.
Any others spring to mind?
Taylor Swift.
Male pop superstar. It's a superstar.
I mean, Michael Jackson.
Okay. All right. This week, I watched The Piano on Channel 4, which is back for Series 2. I didn't see Series 1. I had a friend who kept telling me that I should watch it, which just made me think, you can't tell me what to do.
Classic.
But kept insisting that this was brilliant television. And I think it might have been. I'm not sure that's the case with Series 2, though.
Oh, shit.
So what they do is set up pianos in train stations.
Uh-huh.
But because it's telly, they're nice pianos, not ones that look like they've been retrieved from a shipwreck, which is what the ones in stations tend to look like.
Uh-huh.
And from what I understand, in Series 1, what would happen is people would just wander over and play it, often being ignored by commuters,
mm-hmm.
which is what we all do.
Yeah. It's always like, don't look at me. But look, it's don't look at me, look at me. And I'm like, I'm not fucking giving you the satisfaction.
It's kind of a nice idea in principle, but something I've noticed is the people who sit and play them in the station often, for no discernible reason, look like the kind of people who would also be comfortable juggling or riding a unicycle.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that was kind of the format of Series 1. People go and play these pianos. Then all of a sudden, Claudia Winkleman.
Claude.
And the two judges would come out. And they would find out that they had been chosen to take part in a concert.
All right. Doesn't sound like it's for me, but I get it.
Series 2, this show has become a phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
So it seems now that the second people see a nice looking piano in a station, they know it's for Channel 4's The Piano. And a crowd gathers round instead of ignoring them. And I think the contestants, and maybe this was always so, are pre-researched. But whatever the thing is that made people have such a strong reaction to the first series, I think is now gone because that surprise has gone.
Right.
I'll tell you who the judges are.
Mm.
They are the world famous concert pianist Lang Lang.
Okay.
And as the voiceover describes him, pop superstar Mika. And I'm not saying Mika hasn't had an enviable career, but I think the words pop superstar are being bandied around.
Oh, pop superstar Mika.
There's something about this show that is just trying a bit too hard to push every button.
Claude.
And the phrase pop superstar is emblematic of that. And I am not somebody who watches TV constantly distracted by the way in which it's put together. But with this show, everything in the production was too visible to me.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, the first episode is at Manchester Piccadilly Station.
Uh-huh.
And we see them on the train on the way to Manchester. And it's Claudia Winkleman, Lang Lang and Mika sitting around a table in standard class. And I'm just thinking, oh, here's what happened. They were all in first class until they set up the cameras. And then they said, OK, we're ready for you now. We need 5 minutes if you're having a conversation on the train.
The second you said Claude is in standard class, I went, this is bullshit.
They get to Manchester Piccadilly Station and you see them coming through the ticket barriers and the three of them going, "Woo, Manchester, yeah, let's go." And you just know that the cameras have all had to go and set up the other side of the barriers. And then someone said, "Do you know what would be great? If we could just get you walking through the barriers and just like let us know that you're excited to be in Manchester." Because nobody walks through barriers at a train station going, "Woo, Manchester, woo, let's go, here we go." It doesn't happen. And every bit of the production is visible in that way, including all the emotional manipulations.
Sounds shitty.
It's not quite shitty. is what I'd say. But because the stories are genuinely interesting, and it is very moving to hear people pull themselves out into piano, although you don't hear that much of the music because they're too busy intercutting it with the
Mika
story of how this is an immigrant who likes going out to raves, but she can play piano. And it's a shame because who doesn't like a surprising backstory or a surprising talent? Like, you can get moved even thinking about the life of a humble construction worker who you see sitting on a bench eating a yogurt.
Remember when I saw that doctor late at night getting a Mickey D's? That was hard. All right. I don't think people should watch it. Take whatever time you might have spent watching season two of The Piano and do The Bureau instead.
Or watch season one of The Piano.
Sure.
We'd love to hear from you. I especially would like to hear from you if you watched series one of The Piano and thought it was some great TV, and you either do or don't mm-hmm. think series two has fallen off a cliff. Mm-hmm. Also, any clunky reality TV tropes where you're just too aware of some junior producer saying to them before the camera rolls, okay, here's what we need from you here. Mm-hmm. Have you watched The Bureau? Opinions on that. Is Sarah building series two up too much? Is she going to be disappointed or should she strap in? Also, do you have TV role models or jobs that appear in shows that you think, if I just had the chance, I could do that? I remember showing my brother The Thick of It. And I worry that he saw Malcolm Tucker as a more aspirational character than perhaps he's intended to be. So any other examples of that, please. Plus your TV recommendations and anything you're looking forward to as well. I am so nervous about the film Unfrosted. I'm really worried that this film isn't going to be the thing that I've been living for.
Can I share with everyone my recent observation?
Yes.
It's that thing where it's so many A-list celebrities. And when I see that in a film, I don't go, oh, that's going to be good. I feel the same way I would if I went to a restaurant and they gave me the menu and it had like 100 items on it. If you get handed a menu that's like, here are the four things we do, I go, shit, this is going to be fucking good. You hand me a menu with 30 items, I go, you people don't know what you're doing and you're trashy. And that's what I think about these Hollywood films with so many stars. I think you people don't know what you're doing.
My fear is, so Seinfeld is probably my favorite TV show of all time. And if people know that show, stuff like the way Newman speaks, the way that Peterman speaks, the way that Jackie Charles, the lawyer, is, the very cartoony elements of Seinfeld, it's going to be too much of that without the stuff of life to break it up.
So those
that's my fear. And my fear is Jerry Seinfeld playing anybody other than Jerry Seinfeld is probably too much of a
stretch.
We
also don't know
him.
How he is as a director, which is what he's doing here. I also feel like his wife is very involved in his celebrity world now. And I just like...
Her friends are in it, you mean?
I feel like some of his wife's friends are in it, but I just were concerned.
But what are you looking forward to?
Or afraid of?
And I imagine we'll be talking about Unfrosted on our next episode. So if you want to get in with your thoughts once you've seen it, email us those as well. The email address is...
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com. You know what? We had a nice number of Patreon joiners this week, and I think it's because I was sick.
Well, you think people felt sorry for you?
Yeah, I do think people felt sorry for me, and that was really nice. Here's what I want your money for the Patreon. You know, we were talking about my 80-year-old dad and that it's his time to die, even though I hope he's got another 10 years, 15, maybe 20 in him. But what you must understand is that every time I see my dad, and he's getting old enough now that he doesn't like coming here. Although I'll tell you what, that's less about his aged body. Because I think his bod, I think my dad's 80-year-old bod.
It's
this
hot.
Is about the Patreon. This is about the Patreon. And I want you to be thinking about joining the Patreon while you think about my dad's old bod. It's actually an okay bod to fly across an ocean. But his mind is not okay to fly across an ocean because he gets so anxious as a traveler.
He gets very het up,
doesn't
he?
He was an anxious traveler when he was 40. So at 80, he is really fucked when it comes to flying.
It's not about plummeting to his death on the plane. It's all the bits
the
of going through the airport
and
getting
and
to the right desk.
And does he pick the right desk? He has such a hard time. It's so hard for him. His anxiety gets so bad. Like, I have been in a car with my parents, and the level of anxiety they have just finding a parking spot.
They are more anxious finding a parking spot than the late O.J. Simpson was whilst being pursued by the police.
Yes, it's like nothing you've ever seen. So I have to go to Chicago more regularly because my dad's 80 now. And when I hug him, I think, this could be the last time I see my dad. And I can't fucking afford to be going to Chicago as much as I would like. You should pay for it, okay? All of you with your little 3-pound, 5-pound, 10-pound contributions. I can probably count on my hands and toes how many times I see him before he dies. And let's get that number up. I like my dad. I'll be sad when he dies. Hey, maybe my mom will go first, but we all know my dad's going to go first because that she's living till she's 115. I know it. Join the Patreon. Help me see my father many times before he dies.
Patreon.com/they like to watch. And coming up later, writer, creator, showrunner of The Regime, Will Tracy. And I'm not going to give away a spoiler, but in the course of the interview, a very deep connection
deep
between
connection.
Us and him comes to light. And Sarah was not aware of this connection. And you lose your mind. So you've got that to look forward to. All right, I thought we could go back to Baby Reindeer this week because it is such a phenomenon, and because I've seen it now, it's number one on Netflix worldwide.
Wow.
It stars Richard Gadd, who's also the creator and writer. It began its life as a stand-up show that he did based on real events. It is in large part about a woman stalking a man. And you may remember that when Sarah talked about it the other week, you said that you had shared a car ride with him at some stage.
Yes.
Now, we were at an event last week and Richard Gadd was there.
Yes.
And he looked straight at you with, I would say, zero recognition, which has left me wondering, are you in fact some kind of fantasy stalker? Will his next show be about you?
He didn't look at me.
He did not look at me. You're kind of right. He looked through you.
Yeah, he looked through me. But that's not looking at me with zero recognition. I'm not saying that if you said my name to him, he would remember me. But I'm not making up that I shared a taxi drive with him. Check my Instagram messages. All I did was message him. I messaged him to see if he would come on the podcast. He didn't read it. But he's got bigger things going on right now.
So like the woman in the show, you've sent him lots of messages and he hasn't responded.
I've sent him one message that he didn't respond to.
Okay.
He's a big boy now.
So I can really see what the fuss is about with this show. It's not perfect, but it feels so original and clear of voice. He plays a fledgling stand-up in it. Now, there is one scene where he's doing some tiny tin pot little gig. It's going badly. He's bombing. She is there and she's laughing loudly. So he starts mocking her from the stage. Was that triggering for you?
Let me tell my tale.
Your truth.
Let me tell my truth. I tell this tale, T-A-L-E, from the position of my T-A-I-L, being between my legs post the Seth Meyers situation, which is that I completely misjudged a fact about a person. I will state here publicly that I believe that Sarah Silverman is not a nice person, okay? When I was 23 years old, I bought a ticket to see her show. Oh my God, so glitzy, so glammy. Yes, please, please. I go on my own to see this show. And it was, a lot of stuff is about her butthole and her vagina, which is very, very funny to me, especially when I was 23. And as a purveyor of comedy myself, I know, like, you can do something sometimes that doesn't move a room, but it's really tickling one person. So I had that moment with this thing that she was doing that I think was about her butthole singing. So there's one point where I went, I giggle or something, and it's not in step with the rest of the room. I'm a nerdy girl. I'm 23. I'm there on my own. So I go, giggle, giggle. Why don't you do the giggle, giggle?
It's you. Why am I doing it?
Because I'm going to do the impression of how Sarah Silverman responded to it. It was so nasty. Like, I've been in that moment so many times. Or I've been in that moment where I've thought, that little laughter, it might not be someone I'm pushing to hysteria. It might be someone laughing at me. Like, I've had that happen hundreds of times. And I understand what the pressures are when you're on. I understand the whole game. I really do. I cannot understand how nasty your deep heart must be to another woman to go, like she made a bitch face at me and I've never fucking forgotten it. I just think she's a popular girl masquerading as like a down to earth girl.
In a plaid shirt.
In a plaid shirt. She is a talent, but I believe her heart is dark. Like, I almost cried. It was humiliating. It was fucking humiliating.
Somebody that you are, if not idolizing, but you've got on some kind of literal pedestal because they're on a stage and you're enjoying their work, mocking you other than that you're enjoying their work.
To me, it felt like, oh, you're cruel.
Like, it's like something from a nightmare.
Yeah, it was humiliating. And so what I'm trying to do as I'm like recounting that 20 years after it happened is I'm trying to think, what would someone have on me in a similar, like, what's me at my fucking worst?
I've got a list.
Yeah. And I don't think whatever me is at my shittiest, I don't think it has that kind of cruelty in it. The electric cruelty that came out of Sarah Silverman in my face 20 years ago.
The electric cruelty of Sarah Silverman. All right, let me come back to perhaps what doesn't sit with me perfectly about this show. So first of all, I think I had some discomfort in a male-authored show about a crazy woman.
Okay.
But maybe that discomfort is just because I'm a great guy.
You're a really great guy. Yeah. I didn't have that discomfort.
Okay. I think some of it was because the stalker, Martha, is clearly unwell. Something about that power dynamic felt a bit off to me. But I think it corrects as the series goes on because we learn about a different episode of abuse in his past. And something about that balances it.
My only issue with the show in terms of the ethics of it were I blame some lawyers. So I think Richard Gadd had a story to tell and he told it brilliantly. And I do think that if you're making something really, 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 really exceptional, which I think he has done, then like I think slightly different rules apply to you. So it wasn't Richard Gadd's job to go, is she unrecognizable enough? But also, it's like, what the fuck are any of us doing advising on how this should have gone differently? This guy has wound up with a global hit on his hands. They didn't know that would happen. And I just think trying to find fault with the ethics of it, to me, a little bit right now, feels like trying to shit on the new hot thing, because that's inevitably what happens.
I like the way that it's full of grey areas in that the relationships with both the stalker and the abuser are complex and contradictory, because these things are in real life and we all self-sabotage or we all respond differently to a kind of neediness or feel empathy in these different ways. And I thought the presentation of that was particularly good. But just to nitpick, though.
Yeah, I'll nitpick.
One example of how this isn't perhaps best of the best TV. There's a stage at which he receives a phone call and they make the decision not to cut between the two ends of the phone call, right?
Uh-huh.
So we just see him.
Uh-huh.
And I'll give you enough information that it makes sense without being a spoiler.
Uh-huh.
We see him take this phone call from a big shot TV guy.
Uh-huh.
We hear him answer the phone. He goes, hello? And then he goes, what? You want me to write with you on a TV show? But that never happens.
Okay, I just think...
This is what that would actually sound like. You go, hello? Oh, hi. How's it going? Oh. Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. You don't repeat what it is for the purposes of exposition. There are better ways of doing that as a writer.
I am not comfortable shitting on Sarah Silverman and saying anything negative about Baby Reindeer, the biggest hit. ATM.
There's just a few little things like that. I think some of the minor characters, the people he worked with aren't as fleshed out. And the main characters are fantastic. The woman who plays the stalker, Martha, as you said the other week, Jessica Gunning.
She's going to win
win all the awards. His love interest, I think, is called Nava Mao. She's really brilliant. He is fantastic.
Okay, just shut up for one second. Okay. It is so well acted and the tone of it is so strong and it is so well directed and all the pieces of it are so effortlessly put together that I think it does mask a few stray lines that do that kind of thing. Okay? All right?
All right.
Okay.
If you would like to share thoughts on Baby Reindeer, we'd be very interested to hear them. I would say, actually, another reason we came back to it this week is it's the thing that people have been talking about in the inbox.
We got many emails this week and the subject header was just Baby Reindeer, which helped me understand that people are not always up to date on our podcast. Because they'll be like, you guys have to watch Baby Reindeer. I'm like, bitch, we did 2 weeks ago.
But it was good to spend a bit more time on it as well this week.
We want, it's the thing, isn't it? The thing right now. It's the thing.
The email address is...
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
And coming up next, it is the creator, writer, showrunner of The Regime, which is showing on Sky and Now TV here in the UK. It's an HBO show elsewhere.
HBO Max now, baby.
It stars Kate Winslet and the man behind it, and that's not the only thing he's behind.
Uh-huh.
Will Tracy is coming up next. They like to watch.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I should say to you guys right up top, not to feather my cap, but it might be of interest to your listeners, that I am indeed the writer of the line, Din Dins with Fire Crotch and Normcore.
We know this.
I thought it was Will Arbery.
No.
It was Will Tracy.
Will Tracy.
This is an honor even larger than I realized.
Do we
owe you money? Do you think we might owe you money? I genuinely wondered if we owed you money.
No, I should look into that. I hadn't even considered that. Look, I'll accept donations, but no, I shouldn't. I should also say it was not for an episode that I wrote, but I think it was for episode...
John Brown's episode.
John Brown's wonderful episode. But what happens with all the episodes is they go through this period of alts where Jesse will send out the sides for that week's scene work with little notes on the scene saying, should we have a funnier line here or a more emotional line? Or in a spot where there's no line, he might say, should someone say something here? And then we all kind of will... pitch in alt ideas, and then on the day, well, I think it was Tom and Shiv were just walking the door, taking off their coats at Roman's apartment, and I think maybe Shiv made some sort of smart remark, and we didn't really have a reply for Tabitha and Roman. That's it. And my only idea there was that Roman probably, this was kind of might be a weird big deal for him. It's sort of a grown-up dinner where sister and her husband are coming over, and it all feels very like, hello, welcome to my home. And that's the kind of thing that makes him feel like, is this a test? Am I being tested to see if I'm a good dinner man? And so I just felt like he should comment on it.
Well, what a legacy you what a legacy you've left with that line.
It was so nice of you to mention that. Let me ask you as well. Are you, and I apologize that I've come to this interview without this piece of information in my back pocket.
No worries.
Are you a Harvard guy?
No, I did not go to an Ivy League school.
Okay, that's interesting. I thought you were like Harvard Lampoon. Now I run The Onion. Yeah. I am so funny, you can't fucking handle me. And I was so ready.
No, not at all. I did not go to Harvard or right for the Lampoon. Okay. I went to Vassar College, which was
very prestigious,
the school where that Harvard guys used to date Vassar girls. So maybe that's, there's a bit of a connection there, right?
Well, what I wanted to tell you was you've completely changed my perception in the minutes we've been talking of a Harvard guy. But now I realize it's because you're not a Harvard guy. Okay. Anyways, I would like to tell you one of the parts of your show that I found the funniest and then ask you part of the origin story behind that. So when we sat down to watch the first episode, I was actively laughing throughout entire thing. And a decent amount of the work of that was I found this idea of her reaction to humidity and the spore situation so funny. And I was like, I don't think I've ever seen something that's funny in the way this is funny.
I'm trying to remember exactly where that originated. I think probably what I was thinking is when you have someone who's has this kind of unlimited access to resources and this sort of power, and they're very isolated from reality, and they're in this world that they don't really want to leave because they don't really want to be confronted with what's the mess that's happening outside of their bubble. And they want to believe that they're not contributing to that mess, that maybe psychologically something is wrong and they have to externalize that. Well, what is wrong? It can't be me. I'm not a bad person. There's something in the walls. Yes, there's something in the walls that's wrong and it's trying to get me. And so probably came from what could be in the structure itself that she's imagining. And I thought, well, yeah, mold, black mold.
Do you have any hypochondriacs in your family?
Yeah, me. My mom definitely is, and I've inherited a bit of that. I have weird little things like I have to do it. And I had to do it all the time for Succession, but I don't like getting in elevators and riding in elevators. I don't like it if I'm on like a subway train and it stops for a few seconds in between stations. That's a big problem for me. Like I have to pretend as though I'm not going to have a panic response. Yeah.
See, I think you were you were looking for connection in mother's hypochondria.
Well,
but Will has a lot of compassion and kindness towards his mother's.
Yeah, I got no fucking patience for my mom. But I, you know what I was, because I was, you know, when you're laughing at something and you're laughing at it because you think it's good and you think it's like a good observation and something's been well executed. Yeah. But then you get to another level where you're like, this is actually some part of this is about me. And I'm laughing so hard because I feel like I'm watching some combination of me and my mother presented as a dictator, and it's not that far off. And I thought, I wonder if this man's got a lady in his life with similar ways. Felt like a man who knows. So that's what I think I was digging around for.
Something I've wondered about a lot when watching TV is the tone of a show. When does that get established? And what I'm not talking about is what's on the pages of the script, but like the feel and the look and how big the performances are
in the very early phases. And this might just because I come from a real comedy background. I had perhaps deluded myself when I was writing the pilot for the show. I honestly was thinking in my head, finally I've written something that's not a comedy. I think as we got further into it being kind of developed in pre-production, the tone thing was tricky because she's a female leader and it's HBO and Frank Rich is working on it with me, that there would be some sense that, oh, it's like Veep but in Europe, which I don't think it is. I know that some people who read it maybe felt like, is that what they're going to go for? A little bit of that Succession Iannucci vibe. But I don't think you could just shoot the show in a fully Succession style shaky camera verite way, because there's this other thing happening in the show, because it's a fictional country. You're never really told where you are, when you are, and there's this, you know, I know you, I walked with you once upon a dream type of dreamy fairy tale thing happening between those characters and in their love story. So I do think you have to film it in a way that's verging almost on something that feels hyper real or surreal or odd.
So I've wondered if, like, a blessing and a curse for you is that the show is marketed from the minds that brought you Succession. Yeah. So when people switch on the TV, they're ready to be in Succession mode, not in Succession world, but in the rhythm of Succession.
Yeah,
and that's not what this show is. And as the sooner you click into the regime mode, the more you'll enjoy the show.
That's right. I think that's completely right. And it's a weird thing. It's probably half the people are looking to be in Succession mode, and then half the people they're Kate Winslet fans, so they're thinking, oh, it's Mayor of Easttown time, and it's definitely not that either. So I was quite aware of that, and also just quite aware of, I mean, look, I was very much riding two horses when I was making the show, because I was finishing working on the final season of Succession. I was on set the day and they were doing the continuous take of the Connor's wedding with the kids, and watching that and just feeling like, boy, it's not going to be easy to try to make my own little show in the shadow of this.
When you talk about making something while being there for what will, like, go down in history as one of the greatest episodes of television ever.
Yeah.
Is it, I just want to know more about what that feels like, because I would imagine it's really inspiring, but also, like, does it make you want to just put your head in the oven and never do anything anymore?
I definitely felt a sense of, oh God, this is going to be hard for me to compete. And I think the way for me around that psychologically is, well, I'm not competing with it. No. I shouldn't compete with it. And I shouldn't try to make a show that is the same. I should try to do something that is different. You know, the comparisons are going to happen regardless, but I should try to do something that operates within its own kind of tenor.
When was the first time you were in a room with Kate Winslet? And does that kind of stuff, like, does a celebrity who's that high wattage, are you at a place in your career now where that kind of stuff doesn't make you nervous anymore?
It's never been with, like, actors or something. I don't tend to feel that often, because my mind is, like, we're at work. It doesn't occur to me that often. Whenever I've had that feeling, it's been with something that's completely outside of anything that I do for a living. Like, if, like, the one time I met, like, a famous musician that was like, oh, Jesus Christ, right. That made me feel much more like I'm in the presence of an alien. But no, Kate, I should also say that Kate is quite brilliant at entering a room in that meeting and just immediately just going right into engaging with you and making you feel comfortable. So it just never felt that way. I just felt like, oh, I'm being carried along into what felt like we were picking up a conversation that we left off yesterday with her. And you don't feel as if it's a, hello, nice to meet you, and let's get this ball rolling slowly of, like, becoming comfortable with each other. It was an immediate feeling of, yeah. So she's quite skilled in that way.
So was she signed up before you were ever in a room with her?
Oh, yes. Well, I think I had spoken with her on the phone. I was in the production office for season 4 of Succession in Queens. And I got on the phone with her and Frank Rich. At that point, I had written the pilot. And then I think when I'd heard that she was interested, I wrote episode 2 very quickly as a sort of, oh, she's kind of on the fence. Well, what if I quickly write episode 2 that maybe that will entice her more, writing kind of towards her in a way.
What do you find, just in writers' rooms, you'll have people who've written comedy like you have. You'll have playwrights. Do you find that the comedy writers work at a very different speed in terms of being able to churn something out? Because you worked on John Oliver, so, you know, you've got weekly transmission day on The Onion. I imagine it's even more.
Yes, writers' room. The Onion was very similar to a TV comedy writers' room. Yeah, very similar. Yes, I would say that the comedy writers in the room are probably, I don't even know if it's pace, they're used to having to shoot out ideas really quickly, right? Especially if you're in, like, late night television or something like The Onion, where you're on a very tight production deadline, right? And there's not really that much time to sit around and ponder and, like, let me sleep on it. It's just sort of like, no, we need ideas now. So just say as many ideas as you can, and some of them are going to be not so great, and you just move on, and it's fine. in any TV writer's room, probably the people who have comedy experience are speaking more often.
Uh-huh.
And are probably more confident just saying a lot. And, you know, playwrights write alone, right? And they're not, like, used to pitching to anybody. And so it's probably a very different experience for them. And then you get someone like Lucy Prebble, who's kind of starts as a playwright, but can kind of write anything, and feels like she reminds me very much of like amazing hardcore comedy writers who I've worked with in comedy rooms before too. So yeah, she's kind of can just wear any hat.
What a bitch.
Yeah, how dare she? It really is infuriating. It's not fair.
That is really annoying.
Yeah, stay in your lane, Prebble. One of my favorite things is, I think it was during your tenure, but I don't think you were on it. There's a This American Life episode in the writer's room of The Onion.
Oh, yeah. I think that was before I was there, yeah.
I think your writing partner, Seth, is on.
Yes, that's right.
But it just seems like the most brutal environment to try and get.
Oh yeah, I mean that's been the greatest thing to carry forward. I always feel pretty comfortable and unintimidated in a room, probably just because of that Onion experience. Yeah,
God,
I mean you have to sit there every morning with your list of headline jokes and just read them from a paper, and people are just brutal because your job at the Onion is to have this finely tuned kind of cliche radar and sort of, have I heard this joke before?
I mean,
yeah, it's completely frank and honest, and look, they're still in my head. Like if I write an idea or if I write something, I'm still,
what would they
part
think?
Of my brain is still thinking like, what would they think?
What would they think?
And you know, and now Jesse's in my head, so it's the Onion Room and Jesse are in my head constantly. What would they think?
What has the Jesse in your head said to you recently?
He, you know, luckily I talk enough to the actual Jesse that the Jesse in my head, his voice has become not quite as loud because I have the actual Jesse saying much, much nicer things than the voice in my head would. You know, Jesse he's a tough judge of art, including his own. And so you, of course, when you write something and release something without his participation, part of you is thinking like, yeah, he said he liked it, but does he really?
Uh-huh, you know? uh-huh.
You're always going to feel that with him.
How much is too much if you're contacting him, right? So if you're like, oh, fuck, yeah. I don't know. What would Jesse do? What would Jesse do?
Usually it's like I find myself in a situation with a studio or a network or a director or an actor. Like, what would you do in that situation? Uh-huh. I'm curious to hear that, because that is a bit more of a mystery to me, and he has more experience in that than I do. But I don't, if I'm stuck on writing something, I don't email Jesse and think like, what do you think?
Can you write this?
I probably could.
Yeah.
I mean, part of me hopes that none of them will ever see anything that I make, so that I never have to feel, you know what I mean?
No, no.
Because that's how much I think of them.
This is not the Harvard guy. This is not the Harvard guy talking.
I'm sorry, you're not getting like that. And also, not only because they're so brilliant and have such good taste, but they're all so nice that I don't want to put them through the experience of seeing something that I made that they don't really like, and like making poor, sweet Tony Roach have to go through the motions of being like, I liked it. You know,
oh,
I don't want
to have to
do that.
Do you have things that you say when you have friends who make a piece of work that isn't quite landing right? Do you have carefully chosen words that you say?
I mean, the truth, I usually end up being honest with them and saying what the truth is, which is I haven't seen it yet, because there's very few things I do watch. And usually when at the end of the day, it's sort of like a chef doesn't want to come home and watch the Food Network. Like, I don't really want to come at the end of my day, watch like some good television show that's going to make me feel like a fraud or is going to make me like watch something analytically and be like, but what, maybe they should have moved around this scene. It's like, I don't want to have to think about any of that. And so we end up watching like House Hunters International or Escape to the Country, or we'll watch like an old episode of like Friends or Gilmore Girls.
Well, listen to me. As we were talking to you before, and I was listening to you talk, I was like, if I could write the way that he could write, Jeff, I think there's some kind of happiness that would be in my body all the time, yeah, if I could do with jokes what you could do with jokes. I understand you have a higher standard for yourself than I have for myself because you're allowed to because of your talent level. But I want you, Will.
I know where the sentence is going to end. To write my stand-up act
would you mind
for me so that I don't have to.
No, I want this man to be able to sit on the sofa and watch the finest television and be like, I don't fucking care because I'm there or I will get there and I ran the fucking onion and I can watch any episode of The Sopranos and not let anything get to me ever.
I will say that I think part of it is a kind of an insecure thing that makes me not want to watch a great show. I would say mainly, though, it really is sort of like I feel like I've just at the end of the day switched off the creative analytical part of my brain. So I don't want to have to even think about something that's too good.
Well, listen, I think we all know that your career is going great. So I'm going to give you some advice you didn't ask me for, okay?
Okay, good. Here we go.
So, like, I would never sit down at the end of a day and watch, like, a stand-up special that would somehow upset me. And there's a very particular, like, if it's really shitty, it's not going to upset me. And if it's, like, a work of genius, it's not going to upset me. It's accessible excellence that upsets me. It's accessible excellence. But
I'm not going to ask you to name a name. I really want to.
Oh,
but
I'm going to, we're going to finish in a second, and then I will name some names, and then I want to try and gossip with you about, like, a little bit of a thing.
Yeah.
So here's what I do. But you're doing a little better than me, so maybe don't follow my advice. But if I'm gonna but I should watch the thing. It'll be good for me to watch accessible excellence. I should expose myself.
Okay. Yeah.
So I watch stuff that allows me to switch off in the evening. But then if there's a day where I'm like, I'm gonna watch that stand-up special, but I'm gonna do that at like 11 a.m. and that is part of my work day.
Good. I think that's really smart. And also, I want to thank you for introducing me to that idea of that category of entertainment of accessible excellence. You're right. It is the accessibly excellent things. It's sort of a little bit like, I'm tired of hearing about this thing that everyone loves that I know is great. And it can get a little bit annoying. I know what you mean. That's what it is. You're right.
Well, a man with whom we will be inextricably linked for the rest of our lives or until we stop doing this podcast.
What a wonderful man.
Yeah.
So he was a great guy. I would love to see his property that he's living on in Western New Jersey.
Why don't you send him an email asking for some photos?
Be too weird.
Why don't you look him up on Zillow?
You just got a sense of like a nice house with some good taste.
Was he home on the range?
It felt like he was almost home on the range. And I think, I don't understand exactly the commute from that house he's living in to the middle of Manhattan. But in my little Will Tracy lives his life fantasy, it's not that bad. He's not doing it every day.
Is he taking the path?
Oh, God, he's taking the path. I don't want to talk about that right now. I don't want to talk about the path train. Anyway, great guy, good life. I bet if I met his wife, she would reflect wonderfully on him. I got that vibe. Wishing him all the very best. Continued success for Will Tracy. That's my wish.
All right. What's been dropping on the e-doormat this week?
That's gross.
You don't like the e-doormat? It's not good. It's not good.
No.
Do you know I'm ashamed that I said it.
No, I think it's okay, huh?
No. We're drawing attention to it.
First email this week comes from Elaine Bennett. Very close to Elaine Bennis. Dear FC and NC, I swear I haven't made the plot of my TV recommendation to you up, Elaine. Did you have to end on a preposition in that sentence? That's a crazy sentence, Elaine. That was a mess of a sentence, but I still understood what you were saying. One man in North Carolina loses his leg in a plane accident that also kills his father. He asks the hospital if he can keep the amputated leg, but it ends up in a barbecue in a storage locker for complicated reasons. Another man then comes and buys the barbecue, finds the leg, and refuses to give it back. War ensues. It's called Finders Keepers on Amazon and sounds ridiculous, but is actually about opioid addiction. Give me my hot topic. Give me my opioids. All right, I'm into it. So, sorry, opioid addiction. Yeah, baby. Also generational trauma, hello, and the lure of fame and fortune. It also features amazing hillbilly accents. Well, one of my star turns when I was still an actor, I'm using that term loosely, both actor and star turn.
Do you mean acting student?
Did I say when I was an actor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I meant acting student. I'm very open about the fact that I have now earned money professionally as an actor. When I was an acting student, I played Yvette Poitier, the prostitute, in the Bertolt Brecht play, Mother, Courage, and Her Children. And I would walk off stage, Jeff, and I would get so many laughs in my part that the other guys waiting to go on stage would go, Diva! They were of a way. P.S. I mostly only know you through your podcast. Sorry, that's fine. You could follow me on Instagram if you want. It's Sarah Baron 1 million, please. So I'm not 100% sure what you look like. I thought you'd like to know that in my head, Sarah looks like the villainous Christine from Selling Sunset. I already Googled it. She looks like a real housewife. I don't even understand how you got there. And she thinks Jeff looks like Patrick from Sewing Bee. I Googled Patrick from Sewing Bee. Patrick from Sewing Bee looks like if you were being...
Well, handsome.
Like, you know how there's like a little bit more handsome, like it could be your handsome brother, but then there's more handsome, like if it was the Hollywood version of the story.
Mm.
Patrick looks like you in the Hollywood version of the story.
I look like me in the British version of the story.
Yeah.
I would never be cast in my own life story looking like this.
Exactly. I need to know, Elaine, is that, I Googled Christine Selling Sunset. And like a psycho blonde who's had a lot of work done showed up on my screen. How I sound to you?
You want to know if you should be feeling slighted or not.
I guess so. I mean, she listens to the pod. Anyway, Elaine, thanks so much for writing in.
This comes from Sarah Reed, who says, get well soon, Sarah.
That was the subject header.
Firecrutch and Normcore, I'm writing to say that you were both bang on about The Assembly and Baby Reindeer. Both programs were excellent, although your interview with The Assembly team, I did wonder why you didn't think David Tennant wouldn't be a great guest, given how many times Michael Sheen name-checked him.
I have an answer to that. Do you?
Cookie on cookie. We've already had Michael Sheen, so we don't need David Tennant.
No, and also David Tennant is just a sort of open person, and I think you want someone who doesn't offer themselves up easily in any other interview format. That would be my explanation.
For the record, I also think Michelle Visage would be amazing.
That's interesting. Yes, I would rather Michelle Visage. She's ready for anything, and I love to see her take it on.
So, Baby Reindeer was like nothing else I've ever seen. Even the amazing Nanette, Hannah Gadsby, or I May Destroy You. I loved I May Destroy You so much. Didn't quite capture the horror and nuance of Richard Gadd's lived experience.
Okay. I'd have to go back and watch I May Destroy. I think Nanette is just, it's sitting in a whole other category because it's an hour of stand-up. So that, but we'd have to rewatch back-to-back I May Destroy You and Baby Reindeer to decide.
Are we once again comparing pomme and pomme de terre?
Pomme and pomme de terre.
Programs for tweens and teens. Ted Lasso, Schitt's Creek, and the peerless Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Also, Sarah adds, a trope I'm not loving at the moment is revenge relationships, in which two people get together to make their exes jealous but end up falling in love.
That's stupid.
Did that happen to you, Sarah? Is that something you're afraid of happening to you? Boring, she says. Maybe not. Having originally come from Scotland, I live in Hertfordshire now, grew up working class, and I agree with the sloppy way working class families are represented. I watch a bit of BBC Scotland and would like to offer up Two Doors Down and Still Game. And from the north of England, Alma's Not Normal is stunning.
That was a good show.
Yeah, that was really good. Is that coming back?
It must be coming back, yeah. She's on Taskmaster right now.
Keep up the good work, guys. We like to listen to They Like to Watch. Bye for now. Sarah Reed.
This next email comes from Jeanette. Jeanette, I think your last name is pronounced Esau. Am I getting that right? From Jeanette Esau. Subject header,
wasn't one... someone in the Bible called Esau?
Yeah. But you're saying Esau. I'm saying Esau.
It looks like Esau.
Sarah, will you follow up it with a phonetic explanation? Subject header, one nitpick about Ripley. Hi, FNN. In episode 2 of Ripley, did it at all bug you that Ripley was not rendered uncut? Oh, sorry, spoilers and whatever. This is about to be a mini Ripley convo, so just check out completely if you don't want Ripley spoilers. In episode 2 of Ripley, did it at all bug you that Ripley was not rendered unconscious by that cement block to the back of the head while he was being pulled by the runaway boat? Wasn't that in episode 4? Doesn't matter. How about when he makes it to the shore after that scene and all the belongings he nabbed from Gimli were still in his pockets? I call bullshit. I was surprised you didn't mention this, Sarah. Underarm meat forever. XOXO Jeanette. Okay, Jeanette, here's what I'll say. I wanted to do a bit of an about face on Ripley. I still think it was fantastic. But, and this is the spoilers, so everyone back out if you don't want to hear this. In what I thought was episode 3 or 4 and not episode 2, we see Ripley kill Dickie Greenleaf. And it plays out in this like electric, magnetic, half hour, no dialogue, just Andrew Scott doing his shit, and it's black and white and it's dramatic. And I thought, wow, people will talk about that bit of TV the way they talked about the Fly episode of Breaking Bad or something like that. But then a couple of episodes later, a sort of similar sequence occurs where he kills the child of Sting and Trudy Styler, whatever their name is. And I thought, nope. And the show completely lost me in an instant. I went from, oh, I really want to keep watching this, this is really, really fine TV, to, no, you did the second by second silent killing 2 episodes ago. I can't sit with you now. So I'm done now, Jeanette. I never went back to it. And my new thing that I would really like to foist on people is The Bureau. Also this week, Stephen Scott thinks we should watch Mammoth.
I like that guy, Mike Bobbins. It's good to get a recommendation because I haven't been sure about that, the idea of it. I suppose I was worried it was a one-joke thing. He's a guy from the 70s who's back in the present day with his 70s values.
Uh-huh.
It's the same joke as Austin Powers.
But that's a really good film.
Life on Mars. Yeah, it's not a bad joke. I suppose it's all in the performance. All right, I'll give that a look.
Rhiannon Gravel thinks we should watch 20 Feet from Stardom. Oh, that is a great film. It's about backup singers.
It's fantastic.
It's really, really good. Jin Wen Yu thinks we should watch. She's got a few. She's got, here are my docs. That's what Jin Wen is saying. Quiet on the Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV.
I started watching that yesterday. It looks fantastic. Tonally, I'm not quite sure how we'd tackle it on the podcast, but I'm up for it.
The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping. And lastly, Brandy Helville and the Cult of Fast Fashion. All right. All sound good.
Send us your recommendations and thoughts, please. The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
This week, Will Tracy liked to watch House Hunters International on HGTV and Discovery Plus, Escape to the Country on BBC iPlayer, Friends on Netflix, and Gilmore Girls also on Netflix. Sarah liked to watch Le Bureau on Amazon Prime. I watched The Piano on Channel 4, and we watched Baby Reindeer on Netflix.
Well, they're saying it's going to get a little warmer. The quote is like, don't expect a heat wave. This has been, you know, what you all know, it's been such a cold April. Here in the UK, ice cold April. Very, very difficult, very hard. Everything is terrible. Listen, I hope it warms up. I pray for me on my birthday. Pray to Jesus. Pray I get warmth and no humidity on my birthday because of my hairs. You might be taking me out. I'm very happy if you don't take me out. Also, I really don't care either way.
Oh, I'm taking you out.
I bet you are. So I'm going out for my birthday, right? I don't know where. And my hair will be better. I've completely stopped washing my hair at this stage of my life.
On the advice of a hair expert.
Yeah. But
it's not like you've given up.
No, but I had my hair done professionally and my makeup done professionally this weekend. I had to be like, is it okay that I don't wash my hair? This was before she'd ever met me. And I was like, that, you don't want to be getting that in a text. Like, hey, I haven't washed my hair in a month. We cool? Have a great week, everyone. Au revoir!
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.